The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, first published in 1532. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Part 2, Chapters 12 through 19. Part 2, Other Aspects of Political Power. Chapter 12, Different Kinds of Armies, Mercenaries. Now that I have given a detailed account of the kinds of principality that I set out to discuss, have paid some attention to the causes of their flourishing or failing, and have shown the methods by which many men have tried to acquire them and retain them, I turn to a less detailed account of how each kind of principality can be attacked and defended. I have spoken of how necessary it is for a prince to have firm foundations for his power, otherwise he will go to ruin. The chief foundations for all states, new states as well as old or composite ones, are good laws and good armies, because a poorly armed state can't have good laws, and a well-armed state will have good laws. I can set the laws aside and address myself to the armies. The army with which a prince defends his state will be either his own, or mercenaries, or auxiliaries, that is, soldiers belonging to and commanded by some other prince, or some mixture of these. Mercenaries are useless and dangerous, and any ruler who relies on them to defend his state will be insecure and in peril, because they are disunited, ambitious, undisciplined, and disloyal, courageous when they are with their friends, cowardly in the presence of the enemy. They have no fear of God and don't keep their promises. With them as his army, a prince is safe only as long as they are not required to fight for him. Why? Because they have no affection for you, and no reason to go to battle except the small wages you pay them, and those aren't enough to make them willing to die for you. They're ready enough to be your soldiers while you aren't at war with anyone, but when war comes, they either desert or run away on the battlefield. It shouldn't be hard to convince the reader of this, because Italy's downfall has been caused purely by the long period of reliance on mercenaries. For a while they seemed powerful, and actually won some battles against other mercenaries, but when the foreign armies showed up, the mercenaries were revealed in their true colours. That's how it was possible for Charles VIII of France to seize Italy almost without fighting. Savonarola told us that our sins were the cause of Italy's troubles, and he was right. But the trouble came not from the sins he was thinking of, but from the ones I have described. They were the sins of princes, and it is fitting that the princes have also suffered the penalty. I want to show more clearly how unsatisfactory mercenary armies are. If a given mercenary commander has high virtue, then you can't trust him, because he will be busy pursuing power for himself, either by turning against you, his employer, or by attacking people whom you don't want to be attacked. And if he doesn't have high virtue, his incompetence will work against you in the usual way. Someone might object, "What you have said about mercenary commanders holds for anyone with soldiers under his command, whether mercenary or not, so it doesn't matter what kind of soldiers a state's army has." I reply that it matters greatly, and that when armed force is to be used by a prince, then the prince ought to go in person and put himself in command of the army. And when a republic goes to war, it has to send its citizens as commanders. When one is sent who doesn't turn out satisfactorily, he should be recalled. And when a commander turns out to be very capable, there should be laws that forbid him to exceed his assigned authority. Experience has shown princes and republics with their own armies doing extremely well, and mercenaries doing nothing but harm. And it is harder for a citizen to seize control of a republic with its own army than to do this with a republic that relies on foreign troops. Examples of the advantages of a republic's having its own army: Rome and Sparta stood for many ages armed and independent. The Swiss today are completely armed and entirely independent. Examples of the troubles republics get into when they rely on mercenaries. In ancient times, the Carthaginians were attacked by their mercenary soldiers after the first war with the Romans, although the mercenaries were commanded by Carthaginian citizens. The Thebans, after the death of their general Epaminondas, gave Philip of Macedon the command of their army, and after victory he took away their liberty. When Duke Filippo died, the Milanese engaged Francesco Sforza to lead their troops against the Venetians. He defeated the Venetians at Caravaggio, and then allied himself with them to crush his employers, the Milanese. His father, having been engaged as an army commander by Queen Johanna of Naples, left her unprotected, so that to save her kingdom she had to appeal to the King of Aragon for help. It may be objected, there are striking counter-examples to your thesis about the danger of hiring mercenaries. The Venetians and Florentines extended their dominions by the use of mercenaries, and their commanders didn't make themselves princes, but defended their employers. I reply that in this matter, the Florentines were favoured by chance. Some of the high-virtue commanders, who might have been threats, weren't victorious. Others met with opposition, and yet others turned their ambitions elsewhere. One who wasn't victorious was John Hawkwood, and since he didn't conquer, his loyalty can't be proved, but everyone will agree that if he had conquered, the Florentines would have been at his mercy. Sforza had Braccio's people always against him, so the two mercenary leaders kept one another in check. Sforza turned his ambition to Lombardy. Braccio went against the church and the kingdom of Naples. But let us look at what happened quite recently. The Florentines appointed as their army commander Paolo Vitelli, an extremely shrewd man who had risen to great prominence from being an ordinary citizen. There's no denying that if this man had captured Pisa on their behalf, the Florentines would have had to retain his services, because they'd have been lost if their enemies hired him as a commander. And if they did keep him, they would have had to obey him, meaning that there would be nothing to stop him from installing himself as their prince. As for the Venetians, if we look at their achievements, we see that they fought confidently and gloriously so long as they made war using their own men, with nobles and armed commoners fighting valiantly. That was in sea battles. When they began to fight on land, they forsook this virtue and followed the Italian custom of hiring mercenaries. In the early stages of their expansion on land, they had little to fear from their mercenary commanders, because they didn't have much territory for the commanders to eye greedily. And because of their great reputation, which will have scared off any mercenary who wanted to go up against them. But when their domain expanded, as it did under Carmagnola, the Venetians got a taste of the trouble that mercenaries can bring. They saw what a high virtue soldier he was. They beat the Duke of Milan under his leadership, but they also saw how lukewarm he was about the war against Milan, and were afraid that he wouldn't bring them any more victories, because he was no longer victory-minded. So they didn't want to keep him on their payroll, but they wouldn't, couldn't, just dismiss him, because that would threaten them with the loss of all the territory they had gained, the threat coming from an enemy whose army was commanded by the able Carmagnola. To keep themselves safe, therefore, their only option was to kill him. They recalled him to Venice for consultations, then accused him of treason, and tried and beheaded him. After him, they had several mercenary commanders who didn't create a fear of their winning victories, and then getting out of hand because they usually lost, as happened at the Battle of Vela, where in one battle the Venetians lost everything they had acquired through 8 centuries of effort. The use of mercenaries brings a widely spaced series of slow, minor victories and a rapid rattle of large defeats. These examples concern Italy, which has been ruled for many years by mercenaries, and I want to discuss more fully the problem that they raise, because a grasp of its origins and its growth will contribute to finding a solution. The essential background facts are that in recent times the empire has been repudiated in Italy. The Pope has acquired more worldly power, and Italy has been divided into more states. Many of the great cities took up arms against their nobles, who had ruled oppressively with the emperor's support. The church sided with the rebels, as a way of increasing its worldly power, and in many other towns private citizens became princes. The upshot of this was that Italy fell partly into the hands of the church and of republics. The church consisted of priests, and the republic of civilians, and both started to hire foreigners to do their fighting. The first successful mercenary commander was Alberigo d'Arconio, of Romagna. It was through learning from him that Braccio and Sforza and others were, in their time, the arbiters of Italy. After these came all the other mercenary commanders down to the present time. And the result of all their virtue has been that Italy was overrun by Charles of France, robbed by Louis of France, ravaged by Ferdinand of Spain, and insulted by the Swiss. A fundamental fact about the mercenary commanders is that their armies contained far more cavalry than infantry. The reason was that each soldier had to be paid and fed, so that there was reason to keep the sheer number of soldiers down. More territory can be controlled, and more respect gained, with a given number of cavalry than with the same number of infantry. Also, the mercenary commanders did everything they could to lessen fatigue and danger to themselves and their soldiers. In battle they didn't kill, but merely took prisoners, whom they then freed without even demanding ransom. When a mercenary force was besieging a town defended by another mercenary force, neither side was willing to attack at night. The besiegers didn't protect their encampments with stockades and ditches, and mercenary armies didn't campaign in winter. All these things were permitted by their military rules, which they devised, as I have said, to enable them to escape danger and hard work. And so they have brought Italy to slavery and humiliation. Chapter 13. Auxiliaries, Mixed Armies, Citizen Armies. Auxiliary armies, which are what you have when you call on some other ruler to come with his forces to help you to defend your town, are the other useless kind of armed force. Pope Julius tried them very recently, having seen how miserably his mercenaries performed in his Ferrara campaign. He turned to auxiliaries, and arranged with King Ferdinand of Spain to come to his assistance with men and arms. Such an army may be useful and good in itself, but they are almost never helpful to a ruler who asks for them to come across to help him. If they lose, he loses too. If they win, he is their prisoner. There are plenty of examples in ancient history, but I want to stay with Pope Julius II's obviously dangerous decision to put himself at the mercy of a foreigner in his desire to get Ferrara. But his good fortuna brought a third element into the equation, saving him from the likely consequences of his rash choice. His Spanish auxiliaries were defeated at Ravenna. The Swiss, to his and everyone's surprise, rose up and drove out the French conquerors. So Julius didn't become a prisoner of his enemies, because they fled, or of his auxiliaries, because they hadn't given him his victory. But that was incredible good luck. It doesn't make the Pope's behaviour sensible. When the defenceless Florentines sent 10,000 Frenchmen to take Pisa on their behalf, they exposed themselves to more danger than they had ever been in before. The Emperor of Constantinople, wanting to fend off his neighbours, brought 10,000 Turks into Greece. When the war was over, those Turks didn't want to leave. This was the start of Greece's domination by the infidels. Who should use auxiliaries, then? Someone who wants to lose battles. Auxiliaries are much more risky than mercenaries, because with them the disaster is ready-made. an auxiliary army is united in its obedience to someone other than you. When a mercenary army has won your battle for you, it will need time and a good opportunity to do you any harm. They don't constitute a tightly bound unit. You chose them, you pay them, and the outsider whom you have put in command of them won't immediately have enough authority to harm you. What is most dangerous about mercenaries is their reluctance to fight. What is most dangerous about auxiliaries is their virtue. One might almost say, mercenaries are dangerous because they won't fight, and auxiliaries are dangerous because they will. So the wise prince has always avoided mercenaries and auxiliaries, relying instead on his own men, preferring a defeat with them to a victory with foreign troops, because he doesn't think that that would be a real victory. I never hesitate to cite Cesare Borgia and his actions. This duke entered Romagna with auxiliaries. The only soldiers he had were French, and with them he captured Imola and Forli. But he came to think that these forces weren't reliable, so he turned to the Orsini and Vitelli troops, mercenaries, thinking them to be safer. But they turned out to be dangerous also, unreliable in battle and disloyal. So he got rid of them, disbanding the troops and killing their leaders, and turned to his own men. The difference between a home-grown army and those others can easily be seen in what happened to the Duke's reputation as he moved from the French to the Orsini and Vitelli, and from them to relying on his own soldiers, whose loyalty to him increased as time went on. He was never esteemed more highly than when everyone saw that he was complete master of his own army. I plan to stay with recent events in Italy, but I can't omit Hero of Syracuse, whom I have already mentioned when I reported that the Syracusans gave him command of their army in the 3rd century BC. He soon discovered that the mercenary element in this army was useless, because it was led, except at the very top, by officers much like our recent mercenary commanders. He didn't think he could retain the services of these mercenaries, or disband them, so he arranged for them to be cut to pieces in battle. From then onwards, he made war using his own forces and not foreigners. A certain Old Testament episode is relevant here. David volunteered to fight the Philistine champion Goliath, and Saul tried to encourage him by letting him use Saul's own armour. David tried it on, and immediately rejected it, saying that he couldn't use it, and wanted to meet the enemy with his own sling and knife. The moral is that someone else's armour will fall from your back, or weigh you down, or hamper your movements. Charles VII of France, by fortuna and virtue, liberated France from the English, and he saw the need to be armed with forces of his own, and passed laws to establish a national army with cavalry and infantry. His son, Louis XI, later abolished the infantry, and began to enlist Swiss mercenary soldiers. That was the first of a series of blunders which, as anyone can now see, led that kingdom into great danger. Raising the reputation of the Swiss, Louis has depressed the standing of his own army. He has disbanded the infantry, forcing his cavalry to depend on foreign infantry, and they are now so accustomed to fighting along with the Swiss that they seem unable to win any battles without them. The upshot is that the French cannot stand against the Swiss, and they can't do well against others without the help of the Swiss. The armies of the French, then, have become mixed, partly mercenary and partly national, i.e. composed of citizen soldiers. Such a mixed force is much better than a purely mercenary one, or one composed entirely of auxiliaries, but it is nowhere near as good as a purely citizen army. The French example proves this. The Kingdom of France would have been invincible if Charles's military system had been developed, or at least maintained. But men are so lacking in prudence that they will start on something that looks good at the beginning, without noticing that there is poison hidden in it. Compare what I said earlier about diagnosing tuberculosis. A prince who can't spot trouble the moment it is born, and very few people can, is not truly wise. What started the downfall of the Roman Empire? It was their starting to employ Goths as mercenaries. From that time, the Roman Empire began to weaken, its virtue being drained off it and into the Goths. I conclude that a principality that doesn't have its own army isn't safe. It is entirely dependent on Fortuna, having left itself with no virtue to defend it in times of trouble. Wise men have always held, as Tacitus did, that nothing is as uncertain and unstable as a reputation for power that isn't based on one's own strength. What I mean by one's own army is an army composed of one's own subjects, or citizens, or dependents. Any others are mercenaries or auxiliaries. The right way to organize one's armed forces can easily be worked out from how the four men I have discussed, Cesare Borgia, Hiero, Charles the Seventh, David, went about things, and from considering how Philip, the father of Alexander the Great, and many republics and princes have armed and organized their states, procedures that I wholeheartedly endorse. Chapter 14. A Prince's Military Duties. A prince, then, oughtn't to devote any of his serious time or energy to anything but war and how to wage it. This is the only thing that is appropriate for a ruler, and it has so much virtue that it not only enables those who are born princes to stay on their thrones, but also, often, enables ordinary citizens to become princes. And on the other hand, it's clear that princes who have given more thought to life's refinements than to arms have lost their states. Francesco Sforza, a private person with his own armed force, became Duke of Milan, and his sons, by neglecting military matters, went from being dukes to being private persons. Apart from the other evils that come from having no military force, there is the contempt of others, and this is one of the disgraceful things that a prince should guard himself against, as I will show later on. There's simply no comparison between an armed man and an unarmed one, and it is not reasonable to expect an armed man to be willing to obey one who is unarmed. Nor is it reasonable to think that an unarmed man will be secure when he is surrounded by armed servants or soldiers. With their contempt and his suspicions, they won't be able to work well together. So a prince who does not understand the art of war can't be respected by his soldiers, and can't trust them. A prince, therefore, should never stop thinking about war, working at it even harder in times of peace than in wartime. He can do this in two ways, physically and mentally. Physical preparations for war. As well as keeping his men well organized and drilled, the prince should spend a lot of time hunting. Through this, he can harden his body to strenuous exercise, and also learn about the terrain. How the mountains rise, how the valleys open out, how the plains lie, and how the rivers and marshes are composed. All this should be studied with the greatest care, because it gives the prince knowledge that is useful in two ways. A better grasp of the terrain of his own country will equip him to make a better job of defending it. And, secondly, his knowledge and observation of that territory will make it easier for him to understand others. The hills, valleys, plains, rivers, and marshes of Tuscany, for example, are quite like those of other provinces. A prince who lacks this skill lacks the main thing a commander needs, namely the ability to find his enemy, to decide where to pitch camp, to lead his army on route marches, to plan battles, to besiege towns to his advantage. One of the things for which historians praised Philopoemen, prince of the Achaeans, was the fact that in times of peace he thought about nothing but war. When he was out in the countryside with friends, he would often stop and invite them into a discussion. "If the enemy should be up on that hill, and we were here with our army, which side would be better placed? How could we attack him without breaking ranks? If he tried to retreat, how could we cut him off?" Along the way, he would talk to them about all the situations that an army might be in, listen to their opinions, and present and defend his own, so that by these continual discussions he was prepared to cope with any emergency that might arise in time of war. Mental preparations for war. The prince should study historical accounts of the actions of great men, to see how they conducted themselves in war. He should study the causes of their victories and defeats, so as to avoid the defeats and imitate the victories. And, above all, he should model himself on some great man of the past, a man who no doubt modelled his conduct on some still earlier example, as it is said that Alexander the Great modelled himself on Achilles, Caesar on Alexander, and Scipio on Cyrus. Any reader of Xenophon's Life of Cyrus will see how much Scipio profited from imitating him, how he conformed himself in honesty, affability, humanity, and generosity to what Xenophon reported of Cyrus. A wise prince will follow some such rules as these. He won't idle away times of peace. Rather, he will use them as an opportunity to increase his resources to manage times of adversity, so that if his fortuna changes, it will find him ready to fight back. Chapter 15. Things for which men, especially princes, are praised or blamed. The next topic is, how a prince should conduct himself towards his subjects and his friends. Many others have written about this, so I suppose it will seem rash of me to go into it again, especially given the difference between what I shall say and what others have said. But I am not apologetic about this. My aim is to write things that will be useful to the reader who understands them. So I find it more appropriate to pursue the real truth of the matter than to repeat what people have imagined about it. Many writers have dreamed up republics and principalities, such as have never been seen or known in the real world, and attending to them is dangerous, because the gap between how men do live and how they ought to live is so wide that any prince who thinks in terms not of how people do behave, but of how they ought to behave, will destroy his power rather than maintaining it. A man who tries to act virtuously will soon come to grief at the hands of the unscrupulous people surrounding him. Thus, a prince who wants to keep his power must learn how to act immorally, using or not using this skill according to necessity. Setting aside fantasies about princes, therefore, and attending to reality, I say that when men are being discussed, and especially princes, because they are more prominent, it is largely in terms of qualities they have that bring them blame or praise. For example, one is said to be free-spending, another miserly. One is described as generous, another as grasping. One as merciful, another as cruel. One as keeping his word, another as breaking it. One as bold and brave, another as effeminate and cowardly. One as friendly, another as arrogant. One as chaste, another as promiscuous. One as straightforward, another as devious. One as firm, another as variable. One as grave, another as frivolous. One as religious, another as unbelieving. And so on. We'll all agree that it would be a fine thing for a prince to have all the good qualities in that list, but the conditions of human life make it impossible to have and exercise all those qualities. So a prince has to be wary in avoiding the vices that would cost him his state. He should also avoid, as far as he can, the vices that would not cost him his state. But he can't fully succeed in this, so he shouldn't worry too much about giving himself over to them. And he needn't be anxious about getting a bad reputation for vices, without which it would be hard for him to save his state. All things considered, there's always something that looks like virtue, but would bring him to ruin if he adopted it, and something that looks like vice, but would make him safe and prosperous. Chapter 16. The Free Spender and the Tightwad. It's nice to be regarded as a free spender, but this is dangerous for a prince, as I now explain. If you spend freely in an entirely virtuous way, i.e. so that nobody knows about it, that won't do you any good. Indeed, you'll be criticised as a tightwad. So anyone who wants to have a reputation as a free spender will devote all his wealth to this end, and will eventually have to burden his subjects with taxes and do everything he can to get money. This will make his subjects hate him, and in his poverty he won't have anyone's respect. Thus, by spreading his money around, he has offended many and rewarded few. He is now very vulnerable, and at the first touch of danger he will go down. If he sees this and tries to change course, he'll get a reputation for being a miser. Because a prince can't publicly exercise this virtue of free spending without paying a high price for it, if he is wise, he won't be afraid of being thought to be a miser, because no one will think that about him when they see that by reining in his spending, he leaves himself with the resources needed to defend himself against all attacks, and to tackle various projects without burdening his people. His management of his wealth, therefore, works well for the countless people from whom he doesn't take anything, and badly for the small group of people to whom he doesn't give anything, and to whom he would have given gifts if he had followed the free-spending route. Everything great that has been done in our time was the work of someone who was regarded as a miser. Other people's attempts at great things have all failed. Pope Julius II was helped towards the papacy by his reputation as a free spender, but after becoming pope, he dropped that in order to be capable of making war. The present King of France has conducted many wars without imposing any extra tax burden on his subjects, because his additional wartime expenses have been covered by his cost-cutting measures. The present King of Spain wouldn't have undertaken, let alone succeeded in, so many campaigns if he had had a reputation for splashing his money around. Miserliness is one of the vices that enable a prince to govern. It may be objected, Caesar splashed his wealth around, en route to the top position in Rome, and many others have reached the highest positions by spending freely and being known to do so. I reply, either you are a prince already, or you are on the way to becoming one. If you have arrived, this open-handedness with wealth is dangerous, as I have shown. But if you are still on the way, you need to be regarded as free with your wealth. Caesar was one of those who wanted to become the prince in Rome. But if he had survived after coming out on top, and if he hadn't then cut back on his expenses, he would have destroyed his power. A possible renewed objection. Many princes who have done great things with armies have been regarded as very free with their wealth. In answering you, I distinguish two cases. A prince is lavish with wealth that is his own and his subjects, or a prince is lavish with the wealth of others. In the first case, he ought to be sparing. In the second, he ought to take every opportunity to spend freely. As for the prince who leads his army in a campaign, supported by pillage, plunder, and extortion, he has at his disposal wealth that belongs to others, and he had better spread it around, or his soldiers will desert. Open-handedness with wealth eats itself up faster than anything. The more you do it, the less you have to do it with. So you end up poor and despised, or else, because of the means you took to avoid poverty, rapacious and hated. A prince should, above all, protect himself from being despised and hated, and open-handedness with wealth leads you to both. So it is wiser to have a reputation for miserliness, which brings criticism without hatred, than to get a reputation that brings criticism and hatred by trying for a reputation for open-handedness. Chapter 17. Cruelty and mercy. Is it better to be loved than feared? Every prince should want to be regarded as merciful and not cruel, but he should be careful not to mismanage his mercy. Cesare Borgia was considered cruel, yet his cruelty restored order to Romagna, unified it, and restored it to peace and loyalty. When you come to think about it, you'll see him as being much more truly merciful than the Florentines, who, to avoid a reputation for cruelty, didn't intervene, as they could have in a small but desperate civil war between two factions of Pistoians, leaving the two sides to hack one another to pieces, bringing Pistoia to destruction. As long as a prince keeps his subjects united and loyal, therefore, he oughtn't to mind being criticised as cruel, because with a very few examples of punitive severity, he will be showing more real mercy than those who are too lenient, allowing a breakdown of law and order that leads to murders or robberies. Why? Because such breakdowns harm the whole community, whereas a prince's death sentences affect only one person at a time. A new prince is especially strongly bound to get a reputation for cruelty, just because new states are so full of dangers. But he shouldn't be too quick in believing what he is told and acting on it, and he mustn't be afraid of his own shadow, as they say. Rather, he should moderate his conduct with prudence and humanity, not being confident to the point of rashness, or suspicious to the point of being intolerable. A question arises out of this, namely, is it better to be loved than feared, or better to be feared than loved? Well, one would like to be both, but it's difficult for one person to be both feared and loved, and when a choice has to be made, it is safer to be feared. The reason for this is a fact about men in general. They are ungrateful, fickle, deceptive, cowardly, and greedy. While you are doing them good, they are entirely yours. They'll offer you their blood, their property, their lives, and their children, as long as there is no immediate prospect of their having to make good on these offerings. But when that changes, they'll turn against you. And a prince who relies on their promises and doesn't take other precautions is ruined. Friendships that are bought, rather than acquired through greatness or nobility of mind, may indeed be earned, bought, and paid for, but they aren't secured, and can't be relied on in time of need. And men are less hesitant about letting down someone they love than about letting down someone they fear, because love affects men's behaviour only through the thought of how they ought to behave. And men are low-down creatures, for whom the thought of what they ought to do has no power to get them to do anything they find inconvenient, whereas fear affects their behaviour through the thought of possible punishment, and that thought never loses its power. Still, a prince should try to inspire fear in such a way that if he isn't loved, he at least isn't hated, because being feared isn't much of a burden if one isn't hated, and a prince won't be hated as long as he keeps his hands off his subjects' property and their women. When he has to proceed against someone's life, he should have a proper justification, a manifest cause for doing so. But above all things, he must keep his hands off people's property, because a man will forget the death of his father sooner than he would forget the loss of the property his father left to him. This warning needs to be emphasized, because the temptation to go against it is so great. There's never any shortage of excuses for seizing property, because a prince who has lived by plunder will always find pretexts for seizing what belongs to others. In contrast with that, reasons for taking someone's life are harder to find and, when found, are less durable. But when a prince is on a campaign with his army, with a multitude of soldiers under his command, then he absolutely mustn't worry about having a reputation for cruelty, because that reputation is what holds his army together and has it ready for duty. Hannibal has been praised for, among much else, the fact that he led an enormous mixed-race army to fight in foreign lands, and never, in times of bad or of good fortuna, had any troubles within the army or between the army and himself. The only possible explanation for this is his inhuman cruelty, which combined with his enormous virtue to make him an object of respect and terror for his soldiers. He couldn't have achieved this, just through his other virtues, without the cruelty. Historians who have admired his achievements while condemning the cruelty that was their principal cause haven't thought hard enough. To see that his other virtues wouldn't have been sufficient on their own, look at the case of Scipio. His personal excellence made him stand out not only in his own times, but in the whole of history, yet his army mutinied in Spain, simply because his undue leniency gave his soldiers more freedom than is consistent with military discipline. Fabius Maximus scolded him for this in the Senate, calling him a corrupter of the Roman army. One of Scipio's senior officers led a part of his army that did terrible harm to the Laurians. But Scipio, the easy-going Scipio, didn't see to it that they were avenged, and didn't punish the arrogant officer. If he had stayed in command of the army, Scipio's mildness would eventually have tarnished his fame and glory. But because he was under the Senate's control, the harmfulness of this character trait of his stayed hidden, and the trait itself actually contributed to his glory. Back for a moment to the question of being feared or loved. I conclude that men decide whom they will love, while their prince decides whom they will fear. And a wise prince will lay his foundations on what he controls, not on what others control. While not caring about whether he is loved, he should try not to be hated, as I said before. Chapter 18. How Princes Should Keep Their Word. Everyone knows that it is a fine thing for a prince to keep his word, and to live with integrity rather than with cunning. But our recent experience has been that the princes who achieved great things haven't worried much about keeping their word. Knowing how to use cunning to outwit men, they have eventually overcome those who have behaved honestly. You must know there are two sorts of conflict, one using the law, the other using force, one appropriate to humans, the other to beasts. But the first method is often not sufficient, so men have had to rely on the second. A prince, therefore, needs to understand how to avail himself of the beast and the man in himself, because neither of these natures can survive for long without the other. For the beast side of his nature, the prince should choose the fox and the lion. The lion can't defend itself against traps, and the fox can't defend itself against wolves. So the prince needs to be a fox to discover the traps, and a lion to scare off the wolves. Those who try to live by the lion alone don't understand what they are up to. A prudent lord, therefore, can't and shouldn't keep his word when his word could be used against him, and the reasons that led him to give it in the first place exist no longer. If men were entirely good, this advice would be bad. But in fact they are dismally bad, and won't keep their promises to you, so you needn't keep your promises to them. And a prince will never be short of legitimate reasons for not keeping his promises. Countless recent examples of this could be given, showing how many promises have come to nothing because of the faithlessness of princes, and showing that the most successful princes have been those who knew best how to employ the fox. But it's necessary to know how to camouflage this characteristic, and to be a great pretender and dissembler. And men are so naive, and so dominated by present necessities, that a deceiver will always find someone who'll let himself be deceived. There's one recent example that I can't pass over in silence. Pope Alexander VI was deceptive in everything he did, used deception as a matter of course, and always found victims. No man ever said things with greater force, reinforcing his promises with greater oaths, while keeping his word less. Yet his deceptions always worked out in the way he wanted, because he well understood this aspect of mankind. So a prince needn't have all the good qualities I listed, but he does need to appear to have them. And I go this far. To have those qualities and always act by them is injurious, and to appear to have them is useful, i.e., to appear to be merciful, trustworthy, friendly, straightforward, devout, and to be so, while being mentally prepared to switch off any virtue if that will serve your purposes. and it must be understood that a prince, especially a new one, can't always act in ways that are regarded as good. In order to maintain his power, he will often have to act in ways that are flatly contrary to mercifulness, trustworthiness, friendliness, straightforwardness, and piety. That's why he needs to be prepared to change course according to which way the winds blow, which way Fortuna pushes him. So a prince should take care that he never lets anything slip from his lips that isn't full of the five qualities I have been talking about, so that anyone who sees and hears him will think that he has all of them, i.e., that he is merciful, trustworthy, friendly, straightforward, and devout. This last quality, or the appearance of it, matters enormously. Nothing matters more. Men usually judge things by the eye rather than by the hand. Everybody gets to see, but few come in touch. Everyone sees what you appear to be, but few feel what you are, and those few don't have the courage to stand up against the majority opinion which is backed by the majesty of the state. And everybody's actions, especially those of princes for whom there is no court of appeal, are judged by their results. So let the prince conquer and hold his state. His means for this will always be regarded as honourable, and he'll be praised by everybody. Why? Because the common people are always impressed by appearances and outcomes, and the world contains only common people. There are a few others, but they can't find a footing when the majority can point to the prince's success. A certain prince of the present time—I had better not name him—preaches nothing but peace and trust, and is very hostile to both. And if he had ever practised what he preaches, he would have lost his reputation and his kingdom many times over. Chapter 19. How to Avoid Attracting Contempt and Hatred. Having spoken of the more important qualities in my list, I want now to deal briefly with the others, by bringing them under a general point that I have already touched on, namely, a prince must be careful to avoid anything that will bring hatred or contempt down on him. If he succeeds in that, he'll have played his part and won't have any reason to see danger in criticisms of his conduct. What would most get him hated, I repeat, is his being a grabber, a thief of his subjects' property and women. He mustn't do that. Most men live contentedly as long as their property and their honour are untouched, so the prince will have to contend only with an ambitious minority, and there are plenty of ways of easily dealing with them. A prince will be contemned if he is regarded as variable, frivolous, effeminate, and cowardly, irresolute, and the prince should steer away from all these, as though they were a reef on which his ship of state could be wrecked. He should try to show in his actions greatness and courage, seriousness and fortitude, and in his private dealings with his subjects, his judgments should be irrevocable, and his standing should be such that no one would dream of trying to cheat or outwit him. A prince who conveys this impression of himself will be highly respected, and that will make him hard to conspire against internally, and hard to attack from the outside, as long as he is known to be an excellent man who is respected by his people. So a prince ought to have two main worries, one internal, concerning his subjects, and the other external, concerning foreign powers. He can defend himself against foreign powers by being well armed and having good allies. If he is well armed, he will have good allies. And he can easily secure himself against internal conspiracies by avoiding being hated and contemned, and keeping the people satisfied with him. Conspirators always expect that killing the prince will be popular. When they learn that it would be unpopular, they lose heart and give up, because conspiracies are hard enough to pull off anyway. History presents us with many conspiracies, but few successful ones. The reason for the high rate of failure is this. Someone plotting a coup against a prince can't act alone. He has to select as fellow conspirators people he believes to be dissatisfied with the status quo. And by revealing your plan to such a malcontent, you put him in a position to become very contented without you, because he can expect great rewards for denouncing you. When he sees a certain gain from turning you in, and great uncertainty about what good will come to him from joining your conspiracy, he'll turn you in, unless he is an amazingly good friend to you, or a passionate enemy to the prince. To summarise, on the conspirator's side there is nothing but fear, jealousy, and the terrifying prospect of punishment. On the prince's side there is the majesty of his rank, the laws, and the protection of his friends and the state. Add to these factors the goodwill of the people, and it's almost impossible that anyone should be so rash as to conspire against a prince. Conspirators usually have to fear that something will prevent them from going through with their plot, but in this case, where the people are on good terms with the prince, the conspirator also has to fear what may happen after the crime, because the people will be hostile to him and won't give him shelter. Of the countless examples of this that could be given, I select just one, which our fathers might actually remember. Annibale Bentivoglio, who was prince in Bologna, was murdered by the Canneschi in 1445. The only one of his family who survived was an infant, Giovanni. Immediately after the assassination, the people rose and murdered all the Canneschi. This came from the popularity that the Bentivoglio family enjoyed in those days in Bologna. It was so great that although, after Annibale's death, there were no Bentivogli left who could rule a state, the Bolognese heard about a Bentivoglio in Florence, who until then had been thought to be the son of a blacksmith, sent to Florence for him, and gave him the government of their city. He held it until Giovanni was old enough to take over. The lesson I draw from all this is that a prince shouldn't worry much about conspiracies against him if his people are well disposed towards him. But if they are hostile to him and hate him, he should fear everything and everyone. Well-ordered states and wise princes have taken every care not to drive the nobles to desperation, and to keep the common people satisfied and contented. This is one of a prince's most important tasks. France is currently well-ordered and well-governed. The French king's liberty and security depend on countless good French institutions, the most important of which is Parliament and its authority. The man who set up this system, knowing the ambition and arrogance of the nobility, thought they needed a bit in their mouth to rein them in. And on the other hand, he wanted to do something to protect the nobles, knowing how much the common people hated and feared them. But he didn't want either side of this to be the king's job, because he didn't want the king to be blamed by the nobles for favouring the people, or by the people for favouring the nobles. So he set up a third party, an arbitrator, Parliament, which could hold back the nobles and favour the common people without bringing criticism down on the king. This has proved to be an excellently prudent way of protecting the security of the king and the kingdom. The lesson we can learn from this is that princes ought to leave unpopular policies to be implemented by others, and keep in their own hands any that will be accepted with gratitude. A likely objection to what I have been saying is this. Look at the lives and deaths of the Roman emperors. Some of them lived nobly and showed great virtue of spirit, and yet they lost their empire, or were killed by subjects who conspired against them. I shall respond to this by recalling the characters of some of the emperors in question, showing that the causes of their downfalls were not inconsistent with what I have been saying. In arguing for this, I'll confine myself to the period 161 to 238 AD, during which the Roman Empire was ruled by this continuous series of emperors. Marcus the philosopher, known as Marcus Aurelius, his son Commodus, Pertinax, Julian, Septimius Severus, his son Antoninus Caracalla, Macrinus, Heliogabalus, Alexander Severus, and Maximinus. The first thing to note is that whereas in other states the prince has only to deal with the ambition of the nobles and the insolence of the common people, the Roman emperors had a third problem, created by the cruelty and greed of their soldiers. It wasn't easy to satisfy both. The common people who loved peace and were drawn to unambitious princes, and the soldiers who were drawn to princes who were bold, cruel, and rapacious, and were quite willing for a prince to exercise his qualities against the common people, so that they could double their incomes by adding loot to their regular pay and give vent to their own greed and cruelty. This problem was so hard that many emperors were brought down by it. Specifically, emperors who weren't naturally authoritative and weren't trained in authority were overthrown. What usually happened, especially with newcomers to the role of prince, was this. They saw the difficulty posed by these two opposing attitudes and tried to satisfy the soldiers and not worry about whatever harm this was doing to the people. They had to do this. Princes might try to avoid being hated by anyone, but when they discover, as of course they will, that this is more than they can manage, they should work really hard to avoid the hatred of the groups with the most power. That is why emperors, with a special need for favourable support, because they were new to this, turned to the army rather than to the people. How well this worked out for each prince depended on whether he knew how to keep the army's respect. That's why Pertinax and Alexander Severus, being men of modest life, lovers of justice, enemies to cruelty, humane and benign, both came to a sad end. Marcus was equally excellent as a person, and was honoured throughout his life. That was because he had succeeded to the throne by hereditary right, with no help from the army or the people, and afterwards the respect he got, because of his great virtue, enabled him to keep both groups in their places, without being hated or contemned by either. But Pertinax was created emperor against the wishes of the soldiers, who, having become used to the laxity of discipline under Commodus, couldn't bear the proper discipline that Pertinax wanted to inflict on them. Thus, having given cause for hatred, with contempt for his old age thrown in, he was overthrown, killed, near the start of his reign. Notice that hatred is acquired as much by good works as by bad ones. Now for Alexander Severus, who was such a good man that many praises were lavished on him, including this. In his 14 years as emperor, he never had anyone executed without a trial. Still, he was regarded as effeminate, and as being under his mother's thumb. He came to be held in contempt, and the army conspired against him and murdered him. The characters of Commodus, Septimius Severus, Antoninus Caracalla, and Maximinus, are at the other end of the scale. They were all extremely cruel and rapacious, men who set no limits to how much they would harm the people in order to satisfy their soldiers. All of them, except Septimius Severus, came to a bad end. He had so much virtue that he could keep the army on his side, although he oppressed the people, and he had a successful 18-year reign. The virtue of Septimius Severus made him remarkable in the eyes of the soldiers, who were respectful and satisfied, and of the people, who were numb with astonishment. This man's achievements were impressive, given that he was a new prince, and I want to give a brief sketch of how good he was at imitating the fox and the lion, which, as I said earlier, a prince must be able to do. At the time when Pertinax was killed by his Praetorian guard, Septimius Severus was in command of an army in Slavonia. Knowing that the Emperor Julian, Pertinax's successor on the throne, he bought his election as emperor from the soldiers of the palace guard, was feeble and indecisive. Septimius Severus convinced his army that it would be right to go to Rome and avenge Pertinax's death. Under this pretext, and without revealing any ambition to become emperor himself, Septimius Severus got his army to Rome, moving so fast that he reached Italy before it was known that he had left Slavonia. On his arrival at Rome, the frightened Senate elected him emperor, and had Julian killed. Septimius Severus now confronted two obstacles to his becoming master of the whole Roman Empire, one in Asia, where Niger, commander of the Asiatic army, had had himself proclaimed emperor when Pertinax was murdered; the other in the west, where Albinus, also at the head of an army, aimed to become emperor. Thinking it would be too risky to declare himself hostile to both, Septimius Severus decided to attack Niger, and deceive Albinus. He wrote to Albinus, saying that although he had been appointed emperor by the Senate, he was willing to share that dignity with Albinus as co-emperor, and that the Senate had agreed to this. And he gave Albinus the title Caesar. Albinus believed all this, but after Septimius Severus had conquered and killed Niger, and calmed things down in the east, he returned to Rome and complained to the Senate that Albinus, instead of being grateful for the benefits Septimius Severus had given him, had treacherously tried to murder him. For this ingratitude, he told the Senate, he had no option but to punish him. Then he hunted Albinus down in France, and took from him his authority and his life. Anyone who looks carefully at this man's actions will see that he was a very ferocious lion and a most cunning fox, feared and respected by everyone, and not hated by the army. It's not surprising that he, though a newcomer to the throne, rather than educated for it as the heir apparent, was able to hold on to power so well. His immense prestige always protected him from the hatred that the people might have had for him because of his violence and greed. His son, Antoninus Caracalla, was an eminent man with excellent qualities, which made the people admire him and the soldiers accept him. More than just accept him, indeed. He was a hardened warrior, who never got tired and despised all delicate food and other luxuries, so that the soldiers loved him. Yet his ferocity and cruelties were enormous, far beyond anything people had known before, so that after countless single murders, Caracalla had many of the people of Rome killed, and the entire population of Alexandria. He came to be hated by the whole world, and also feared by those he had around him, so much so that a centurion murdered him in the midst of his soldiers. It's important to understand that a prince can't protect himself against that sort of murder, planned by a determined mind, because anyone can kill a prince if he doesn't mind dying himself. Still, a prince doesn't have to be much in fear of such an assassination, because they're very rare. He does have to take care not to do any grave injury to any of his servants, or of those he has around him in the service of the state, which is just what Caracalla did. He had shamefully put to death a brother of that centurion, and had continually threatened the centurion himself, yet he kept him in his bodyguard. It was a rash thing to do, and proved to be the emperor's ruin. Let us turn now to Commodus. It should have been very easy for him to hold on to power, because, as the son of Marcus Aurelius, he had inherited it. To please his soldiers and the people, all he needed was to follow in his father's footsteps. But he was cruel, bestially so, and freed himself to steal from the people by currying favour with the soldiers and letting military discipline collapse. And eventually the soldiers came to contemn him. He had no sense of the dignity of his position, often showed up in the amphitheatre to compete with gladiators, and did other sordid things that weren't worthy of the imperial majesty. So Commodus came to be hated by the people, and despised by the army, and fell victim to a conspiracy to murder him. It remains to discuss the character of Maximinus. He was extremely warlike, and the armies, being disgusted with the effeminacy of Alexander, killed him and elected Maximinus to the throne. He didn't keep it for long, for because two things brought hatred and contempt down on him. First, everyone knew about his lowly background. He had been a mere shepherd in Thrace. Second, after becoming emperor, he didn't go to Rome to be formally installed. Maximinus had his prefects in Rome and elsewhere do many cruel things, which earned him a reputation for the utmost ferocity. So everyone was outraged by his peasant origin and afraid of his barbarity. First, Africa rebelled, then the Senate, with all the people of Rome, and all Italy conspired against him. His army, too. They were besieging Aquileia, and running into difficulties. They were disgusted with his cruelties, and their knowledge that he had so many enemies emboldened them to kill him. I don't want to discuss Heliogabalus, Macrinus, or Julian. They were all contemptible, didn't last long, and were quickly wiped out, and I want to get finished with this topic. I'll just say this. It's not nearly as hard for princes today to make their soldiers very satisfied with them. They do have to make some concessions to the soldiers, but that, the unrest in the army and its cure, doesn't last long. None of today's princes have armies with long experience of controlling and administering provinces, as did the armies of the Roman Empire. Back then, satisfying the army had precedence over satisfying the people, whereas now, for all princes except the Turkish and Egyptian sultans, satisfying the people outranks satisfying the army, because the people are the more powerful. What I have written shows that what brought down each of the emperors was hatred or contempt, and shows how it came about that, by what we may call the gentle approach to the emperor's role, Marcus Aurelius was successful, while Pertinax and Alexander Severus were not, and, by what we may call the rough approach to the emperor's role, Septimius Severus was successful, while Commodus, Caracalla, and Maximinus were not. Why the five failures? Since Pertinax and Alexander Severus were new princes, it was useless and dangerous for them to model themselves on Marcus Aurelius, who had inherited his position as prince, and it was utterly destructive to Commodus, Caracalla, and Maximinus to imitate Septimius Severus, because they didn't have enough virtue to enable them to tread in his footsteps. So a new prince can't imitate the actions of Marcus, but doesn't have to take Septimius Severus as a model either. What he should do is to take from Severus the courses of action that are necessary to found his state, and from Marcus the ones that bring glory to a state that is already stable and firm. End of part 2, chapters 12 to 19.